and welcome to the show. I'm Peter Whittle. Now, I'm delighted that my guest this week is, I would call her a friend of the channel, Lionel Shriver, novelist and indeed columnist. She's the author of 17 novels. She writes a column for The Spectator, amongst many other publications. And her latest book, which just come out, is this. It's called Mania, right? And just by way of explanation, it says at the bottom, what if calling someone stupid was illegal? That should give you a little bit of an idea about what it's about. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to see you again.
Great to see you too, Lionel. This book is essentially, it starts, just to set the scene, it starts in a kind of alternate version of this recent past, doesn't
yes.
it, around about 2010. But essentially, what it's about is that what you call the last civil rights struggle, which is the mental parity movement. Mm-hmm. And this is basically where people can no longer be judged or discriminated against on the basis of intelligence. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Right. What kind of world are we talking about then? What can't happen anymore?
Well, first off, I would clarify, we're talking about a world that's very close to the one we already
live
exactly.
in. Well, exactly.
Which yeah. is yeah. why it's so close in time to the present. And it's kicked, this movement is kicked off by a book, which suddenly everyone, first everyone makes fun of it because yeah. the premise is so absurd.
Yes.
Because of course people vary in intelligence. And then it just takes hold almost overnight in the way of these things.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to take a look at is just the whole phenomenon of the social mania, which is why it's called mania.
Yes.
And of course that means that there are no standards, that you can't limit who gets into very tony universities, much less medical schools, that and it also has a big effect on people's daily discourse.
Right.
Because of course it's one of the only insults we're currently allowed to fling at each other.
Yeah.
You idiot.
Yeah. So these are outlawed, are they, essentially?
Yes. In fact, my protagonist, who's a kind of lowly instructor in the university, and she teaches English, and in one of her courses, out of sheer mischief, she assigns Dostoevsky's Guess What?
yes, an idiot.
And it's an outrage, and she yes. almost loses her job.
Yes.
That should give you a clue. It's a playful book. It's a fun book. It's dark in a way, but yes, as the trite flap copy phrase has it, it is darkly comic.
Well, yes. I'd say pretty dark and entirely plausible.
I think so. I don't think it's
plausible.
That crazy.
Because a lot of discussion at the moment is going on, bubbling away in the background, is about the death of meritocracy, isn't it?
Yes.
About basically how, as an idea, this is falling out of fashion.
Yes, it's discriminatory.
Yeah.
And after all, you have to remember that the word discrimination didn't just used to mean being mean to people for no good reason, but it used to mean being selective
yeah.
in a desirable way.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the things we're increasingly no longer permitted to do. And I think one of the reasons that this ideology that I created is plausible is that the left is so utterly consumed with this notion of what they call social justice,
yeah.
which you know we used to just call justice. I think that the left is fundamentally uncomfortable with the fact that we're not all born the same, mm. that's not fair. Mm. And of course, it isn't fair. Some people are born dazzlingly attractive, and it's a kind of cheating. Mm. Some people are taller than others. Some people are smarter than others. Some people have talents that others lack, you know, being good at dance or having a beautiful singing voice. You know, none of this stuff is fair. Mm. Nature is not fair. Mm. And I think the left doesn't like that. And therefore, it is extremely uncomfortable with any differences between groups, which have to be interpreted purely through the lens of the bad kind of discrimination.
What's interesting, in the book, there is one woman, this is her best friend, who basically goes with the flow of the new orthodoxy, doesn't she? But essentially, I mean, at the very beginning, her son has been sent home for calling someone or saying someone was wearing a stupid T-shirt or a dumb T-shirt.
Right.
That was no longer allowed. And so there's this, she's called in to speak to the head teacher or whatever it is. That had the whole ring of truth about it. Not on this front as it stands, but mm-hmm. maybe on the trans issue as it is now, or any of these. I mean, I was just wondering, Lana, when you started to, you said it around about 2010, 2012. Isn't that when the trans thing took off?
Yes, it is precisely when the trans obsession took off. And if this mania is modeled on any other mania, it is probably modeled on transgenderism. I found that movement astonishing. I identified 2012 as the year that suddenly our televisions were blasted with documentary after documentary mm. about little boys wearing dresses. And mm. and it became a cultural fixation mm. almost overnight. And it's a little mysterious how that happened. And I'm not sure I'm going to be able to tell you exactly, except that I don't think that it's a coincidence that it was around about 2011 that gay marriage became widely acceptable mm. and all the alphabet people didn't have anything more to fight for. So mm. the trans thing was their last great civil rights mm. fight. Mm. But I found it really disconcerting. And one of the things that disconcerted me about that, the trans movement, is that at the same time that we were instructed that this is, you know, this is important, these people are sometimes discriminated against, it's a big healthcare issue, we also got the message simultaneously that if we are a little uncomfortable with celebrating what used to be a mental illness, we'd better keep our mouths shut.
Yeah.
And that was astonishing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I was instantly uncomfortable with it. Fine, if you are deluded into believing that you really should be the other sex, I mean, yes, you probably need mm. therapy. Mm. But I was from the start uncomfortable with the fact that the fixating on I feel like a woman or I feel mm-hmm. like a girl, I feel like a boy was culturally regressive mm-hmm. because, I mean, what does it mean to feel like a woman? Mm. I am one and I have no idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the only way that that had any meaning, as far as I can tell, especially as viewed from the opposite sex, was over utter triviality, like dress and mannerisms and how long you wear your hair. You know?
But the irony, of course, of all of this is that it was, you say regressive, entirely. If you were a kid and you didn't kind of basically conform to what kids, male or female, did, well, you were a tomboy yourself. I mean, actually, you were a tomboy, weren't you?
Yes.
Could it not have been, Lionel, that in this day and age, if you were 15 or younger than that, they could have put you on puberty blockers or something.
Oh, definitely. And furthermore, like any sane adolescent female, I found puberty very unpleasant, and I wasn't exactly thrilled about everything that came with it. And if I had been offered a way of getting out of it,
yeah,
I might have taken it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't really blame these girls, because they are being lied to that being female is an option.
Mm-hmm. When you look back to 2012, and whether it is actually in your novel, in Mania, or indeed when it's the trans movement or any of these, people say, oh, well, it's because of social media. You know, okay, that must play a huge part, that these things travel the way they do, you know, all over the world. But it's not the whole story, is it? Because surely people must be suggestible to this thing in the first place, mustn't they? This particular issue or that particular issue.
I totally agree. We're dealing with a human problem, and it's not specific to our time. No. The only thing that is specific to this era is the mode of communication. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can spread a mania more quickly and indeed all over the world in a way that we never could before.
Yeah.
But social, we are as a species prone to delusions.
Mm-hmm.
And not only prone individually to delusions, but easily influenced by our fellows, and suddenly everyone believes the same thing, so I guess we should too. You know, it is a social impulse. Mm-hmm. In fact, my Spectator column this week is about the fact that, well, at least closes on the theory that being a conformist is to your evolutionary advantage.
Right.
That is, just mouthing the shibboleths of your time, saying everything that everyone else says and claiming to believe everything that everyone else does, is a good survival mechanism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, look at what happens to people who stick their necks out. They get their heads chopped off. It rarely pays to be ahead of your time or to be an outlier, to say, you know, I don't believe that climate change is a threat to humanity and we're all going to die in the fires of hell. I've seen some graphs that suggest that the temperature of the planet is actually historically rather cold right now. Mm. We're still coming out of an ice age. No, that's going to ruin your career.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's true on all these things. Only in retrospect do manias look like manias.
Mm.
So it makes perfect sense that everyone goes along with it and eventually genuinely believes it. In fact, the friendship I'm looking at in the book, the best friend, Emery, at first, she makes fun of the mental parity movement along with her friend Pearson. And then she pretends to go along with it because it's in her career interest.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually she completely buys it.
Yeah.
And that's because I think it's very difficult to be disingenuous over a long period of time. It's very hard to cynically mouth beliefs that you don't really embrace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sometimes ask of ourselves, of the wokesters, you know, do they really believe this stuff?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is yes.
Yes.
It's easier.
Yes, it is. Do you think there's anything in this view that, because women have been pretty much the forefront of the woke movement in many
yes.
ways. And some people say, well, actually women, sexist remark coming up, women are more prone to fashion, or they want to be more secure, they want to be more conforming. Do you think there's anything in that?
Yes, these are overgeneralizations, but I'm comfortable making them.
Mm.
women are much, much keener to be liked.
Yes.
You know, they are more likely to seek approval. They think more in terms of consensus. They are risk averse comparatively to men. And in the kind of environment that we're discussing right now, that sticking your neck out is risky.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. And so out of sheer self-protection, it's safer to hide in the crowd and say what everyone else is saying. And as I said, you know, eventually just buy into it wholesale. And I guess the whole progressive shtick is it plays on at least the idea of compassion.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Kindness.
Yes, yeah. Kindness. And at the same time, it feeds the catty instinct. You know, the whole cancel culture thing is very female.
Well, quite the highlight, you know, the damaging of reputations,
yes.
the gossip.
It's very schoolyard.
Yeah.
And that's the way girls act. And they generally do it behind your back. And social media is a great method of doing things, of hurting people behind their backs.
When I said at the beginning that this was highly plausible, I had in mind the whole kind of thing we have at the moment, the diversity, inclusion, equity, D-I-E, or whatever it's called.
I like spelling it D-I-E.
D-I-E, yeah. But equity is a form of this, isn't it? I mean, it's equality of outcome. It's more or less saying, well, you know, when you give people equality of opportunity, then essentially, you know, you're going to have essentially an uneven field after that because people go up and down to different levels. We can't have that, so we're actually going to have something called equity. So really, this is just the logical conclusion of
it. It's a book about equity.
But the thing is with this, is that when I was reading, because I haven't, I'm nowhere near finished yet, is that basically you're talking about the final death of civilization, aren't you?
Yes, and also when everyone's the same, everyone is rubbish.
Yeah.
So, because you can't make everyone geniuses. So basically, you make sure that everyone gets a terrible education. You know, you don't have excellence in any field. And I think that's one of the things that bothers me about the progressive ethos, is that all that matters to them is fairness. And it's as if that is the only value worth preserving. But there are other values on which a successful civilization is highly dependent. Excellence and competence. They're related, not quite the same. People doing their jobs properly, knowing what they're doing, being good at it, and excellence that doesn't necessarily have to do with this dumpy kind of virtue or sad version of goodness right now. I mean, excellence is its own good, in my view, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, lift up the poor.
No.
Right?
No.
A beautiful building, right? Is a good, in my mind, is a good all by itself. But it doesn't have to do with social justice. And I get very impatient with our version of virtue right now, which is small and narrow and I would even call it pinched.
Well, pinched.
Not to mention tedious.
But also, isn't it sort of obsessive about vulnerability?
Aren't you tired of that word?
Yes,
I mean, vulnerable.
Yes, vulnerable.
Basically, starts referring to everyone.
Go through your average newspaper and count how many times you see the word vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's all part of the same thing in a way. It's sort of, it's the idea that, excellence or strengths, even, you know. Mm-hmm. These things are, they're very, the left particularly are very, and the progressive mindset, very suspicious of. Very suspicious.
Well, or to turn it around, the left ceaselessly celebrates weakness.
Yes.
Elevates weakness. Now, as a larger societal value, that's death. Mm-hmm. You know, and it also invites attack. I mean, when forces outside you see weakness, that's they're going to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, flying the flag of weakness and saying, you know, these are the people that these are the people we put forward as representing our civilization. I just think that's deadly.
Mm-hmm. I think again, when I was reading, something occurred to me. I mentioned to you before we started recording this, and that was this sort of sense in which physical attraction, physical beauty could be next on the agenda. I mean, in the sense of almost one is not allowed not to find people attractive. I mean, I know this sounds crazy.
No, it is.
A lot of things
that
we found
were
crazy.
But it's increasingly the case.
Yes.
I mean, the way advertising has changed so much.
Yes.
So that there are all these models that are foisted on us, and the not especially subliminal message is that they're all equally attractive. Mm-hmm. No, they're not.
No, they're not. No.
And also, there is an increasing sense that your personal judgment of others is disallowed.
Well, yes, because it's based on certain, you know, qualities or characteristics in you, which might be ones that are no longer allowed.
That's right.
So how can you say this is a white man? Or that's just a typical, I mean, we're seeing it, I mean, to go back for a minute to knowledge and to, you know, universities, in a way you're seeing it with sort of the general downgrading of science as just being white, you know, sort of a white way of looking at the world, for example. That was something which came to the fore, what, 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah.
It's the same sort of impulse, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, what's been happening in science feels like being stuck in a dystopian novel.
Yes.
It seems improbable that you would have, you know, what's going on in Australia, teaching Aboriginal myth in science class, which is absurd.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with teaching Aboriginal myth in a class about myths or religion. Fine, but not in science and not alongside the theory of evolution or before this kind of stuff happened, it would have seemed impossible. And calling math racist.
Yeah.
I mean, that's funny. That's like a cartoon.
But it is all to bring something down, isn't it, in the end? It's to bring, I see all these things as an attack on, basically, on Western civilization. I don't mean to sound, you know, too grand there, but that's how I sort of see this.
What's bizarre about it is that the people who, as you say, are trying to bring down Western civilization are very dependent themselves individually on Western civilization. Oh, right. I just find it baffling.
Yeah.
The complete lack of awareness that everything they do, everything they own, everything they use is dependent on this functionality of the West. Mm. And I don't know what kind of lives they think they're going to be living without it. Mm-hmm. You know, no Western civilization, you're not going to have updates on your iPhone.
You born and grew up in America. Are you surprised that America seems to be the kind of mothership of this compared to, I can see, you know, when I was growing up, America was, or even as an adult, if things get really bad in Europe, well, there's always America, you know, America. And now I'm afraid I don't feel that anymore.
Yeah, and you don't hear that very much anymore. I'm not surprised in that I think I was there at the birth of it in the main. I mean, you can take it back to the popularity of communism in the 30s or whatever, but I think what we're dealing with right now is much more rooted in what happened in the 1960s. Mm. And I was powerfully affected by that when I first started to travel. I was deeply ashamed of the United States and deeply ashamed of being American. Now I look back on it and it's kind of crazy. And it was also, insofar as that I felt guilty, it was fake guilt. Mm. You know, I was not responsible for massacring the Indians or enslaving the Africans. I mean, as with every country, there were things to be ashamed of and examined and studied, etc. But there was no reason for me to take that upon myself.
Yes.
But it was very popular when I was a teenager and in university to denigrate the U.S. and to find the history of the country shameful. Mm. And then when you were in Europe, you know, you felt apologetic about your accent and tended to be mean to other Americans and about other Americans and about Americans in general. It took me a long time to realize that this was not attractive to others. Right? When you're disavowing your own kind, that is, you know, that doesn't please. It is an effort to please, but it is not pleasing. And I went through something of an epiphany on that point and then just stopped trashing the U.S. altogether. I mean, that didn't mean that I got on board with everything politically that the U.S. was doing, whatever. But of cultural disavowal and embarrassment about my accent, I put that aside. But I think that what we're dealing with comes from that era. Mm. And one of the big changes is that in the 60s, I learned to be ashamed of my country, but I was still in a tiny minority. You know, we misremember the 60s. Oh, they're all long hairs and hippies and it was nothing but peace and love. And, you know, those are the pictures we've got. But the truth is that most people weren't a part of that.
No.
Republicans were in control. It was still, in the main, common to be patriotic. Mm. And that made it possible, the luxury of being anti-American as an American, because it was a minority position. Now it's a majority position. Now it is the mainstream view of the country within the country. And that is unsustainable.
Well, I suppose that's one of the things I feel saddest about, actually. You know, because in this country, as you well know, the British don't go in for flags, the British don't go in for X, Y, and Z. Mm. The attraction of America was that lack of shame. You know, it was that confidence and it was all of those things. That's why I feel so sad that I feel that America is lost to me, is that it's no longer, in fact, you put it very nicely, it is no longer the ruling culture. It's no longer, there are pockets, aren't there, of maybe what we might like, but it's not it doesn't inform the whole anymore.
Well, the anti-Americans are in control.
Yeah.
So it almost doesn't matter how the main of the population feels. The institutions are completely controlled by the progressive left. Mm. The weird thing that's happened with Britain is that you're right, that the culture originally has always been rather humble, very quiet about patriotism, which is different from not sticking up for your country when you're required to. Mm. But yeah, not big flag wavers. But the what has happened is that you had that modesty and quietness already, and then in the United States we've got our shame culture going and we've exported it back to you.
Yes.
So there's there was a culture that was already vulnerable to you know, a quiet patriotism tipping over into no patriotism. Yeah. And you've been infected by this same self-hatred and negativity. One of the things that's happening in Britain, which is also happening in the US, is that the more you trash your country and your entire civilization, the more the conceit is that you can somehow opt out of it, right? So that none of these people trashing Western civilization believe that they're trashing themselves, right? So all the generalizations, all the meanness that they subject their own countries to, for some reason, just because they're being mean, it gives you a free pass. Mm. You know, you're talking about them. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I understood when I had my epiphany, is that if I'm going to trash Americans, then I am talking about myself. Yeah. There is no opting out. You can't make generalizations about groups of people to which you belong if they don't also apply to you. And I feel a little self-conscious about that because we just had this conversation about women. and so I was actually doing the same thing.
Well, though, you have actually got here this phenomenon that David, and in America, but David Goodhart talks about, you know, the somewheres and anywheres. And where the anywheres, I would imagine, are people who, although they might be British in this case, English, really don't have any sense at all of connection, so will happily trash. I mean, they're the people who, when they're abroad, will say, oh, God, I didn't vote for Brexit. Oh, God, you know, the idiots did. So I think that, they are definitely there. But I think your point about quiet patriotism slipping over into no patriotism is what is happening actually at the moment, because quiet patriotism in Britain kind of did rely on a sort of sense of superiority anyway.
Yes, it did.
You know, it's sort of, we don't have to.
It was fake modesty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very fake. And, you know, so when Cameron said we don't do flags, you know, it was kind of typical of someone like David Cameron to say that in a way. But I feel now, looking at it, Lionel, that actually the situation has changed so much that, for example, we've got to do flags, for example.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that a return to some simple, fundamental expressions of pride, pride of place, pride of culture, I think it's called for. The kind of thing is called for that I don't have any real appetite for. I mean, I don't like pageantry. Mm. I'm not really big on all the royal what have you in Britain. It's a taste thing. It doesn't interest me. But I think it's, at this point in time, it's healthy. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go watch the Changing of the Guard or something.
No.
But at this point, I would say, you know, the royal family is probably good for this country, and if I were you, I would hang on to it. Mm. And these exercises of you know, celebrating the country and its history are more important than they ever have been.
Well, exactly. But it's because when you think of the onslaught that our countries, I mean, we're talking about the English-speaking world, aren't we? But say Britain or America have gone through in the past, 4 or 5 years, you can understand people suddenly wanting to cleave, you know, things to themselves. I mean, for example, I have a friend who now lives in Italy. She's taken the kind of Benedictine option of going to a very beautiful place to live. Mm-hmm. But she was at Reuters for ages. And she just sort of, she was always a kind of liberal lefty, and suddenly took a great interest in what's happening to the Queen. You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Bought Enid Blyton books from the internet for fear that they just wouldn't be allowed anymore. I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but I've kept all my records and CDs just in case, you know, that the whole thing comes shattering down and that somehow or other, you know, you've got sort of physical things there.
Well, something seems more precious when it's endangered.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, also in Australia, you know, they tried to stop Australia Day.
Yes.
What did they want to call it?
It wasn't even a name of anything.
Yeah, they actually had a new name for it, which was, you know, take over other people's land day.
No, that's, I get the picture. No, it's exactly it. No, it is, it's pretty much ever.
But that's the kind of, that makes Australia Day more important.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It makes it more meaningful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this sounds terribly ingratiating, but you'll have to sort of put up with it. Other than Michel Houellebecq in France, I don't think I know of any other novelist, Lionel, who actually writes about things that are happening.
Mm.
Unless you can tell me some good ones, you know. I mean, you're the only person. This one happens to be about what we're talking about, mm-hmm. with the particular manias. But then, of course, you've done healthcare, mm-hmm. the financial crisis, actually, Big Brother wasn't just
obesity,
about obesity. That was the health service, wasn't it? I mean, you would.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it was about healthcare in the U.S.
Yeah, but basically, your stories are played out in this situation. Now, most novels now really don't seem to be about very much. I mean, I know they've said that about novels for years, or rather, I know what I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. First off, almost all novelists in the Anglosphere are left-wing.
Yeah.
And so I would also set myself apart in that I don't know what to call myself besides conservative these days. Calling myself libertarian didn't work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
understood what it meant.
Yeah.
So I have basically the same opinions I always have, but the world has lurched left, and that's leaving me conservative, and maybe I should stop apologizing about that and just embrace it. But yes, I am the only non-left novelist I know.
Mm-hmm.
And yet most of the population agrees with me on most points.
Yes, exactly.
That's what's
yeah.
so weird. Yeah. What that means is that my colleagues are either writing left-wing books or they're avoiding all subjects that are dangerous.
Mm. Mm.
And so they're either writing about racism is bad, or they're making sure that if they're white writers, that there are no black people in their book. Just.
Well, yes, because.
Which is a weird kind of racism.
Yes, exactly. But when you last were on, we were talking about the publishing industry and staying in your lane and
yes.
all of that. I mean, you're talking about 3 or 4 years maybe ago now, but. That's, if anything, that's just tightened, hasn't it?
It's got worse. Mm. You know, and, you know, I'm sick to death of being the only one who's willing to trash the idea of cultural appropriation, but it's alive and well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's often referred to as just a fact.
Mm.
Like, one of the things that you're flat out not supposed to do, and it's just, we all understand that, oh, you know, the only question is, was that cultural appropriation or not? Because if it was, then it was wrong and it shouldn't have ever happened.
Mm.
And it was a kind of theft.
Mm,
mm. So I'm afraid that concept has become entrenched.
Mm, mm.
But for fiction writing, it's deadly.
Mm, yes. Well, I mean, for creativity generally. Yeah,
yes, yes. In fact, all these rules,
yeah.
rules period, yeah. are not good for creativity, and except insofar as they challenge people to defy them.
Yes, yes.
So I'm definitely out to defy the rules. I, you know, my response to anything I'm told I can't do is to do it.
Mm.
But I think writers who are on the left feel they still have to please the left. And then they paint themselves into a corner. And I experience much more freedom, much more creative freedom than someone who identifies as progressive and just wants to make sure they don't offend anyone. That is not a great motivation for writing a great book.
I suppose the test in some ways as well, or rather what would demonstrate that very well, is that when you did, we need to talk about Kevin, that was made into a film, which was also highly praised. The film was considered good. I wonder whether any of these later novels would ever make it into a screenplay, you know, onto Netflix, say. I doubt it. Not because they wouldn't be great. Mm-hmm. I'd certainly watch something like that. But wouldn't they be
too... Yeah, it would be a fun film.
Yeah. But I mean, what I mean is, would they say, oh, we can't, you know, have you saying this, or we can't have that character. Would they take it on with
no,
that subject?
For the most part, no.
Yeah.
You know, I now have a reputation, a bad reputation, for being, you know, a right-wing novelist.
Mm-hmm.
Not a right-wing novelist, it's ridiculous.
Well, a non-left.
But anyone who's non-left is right-wing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
oh, no, no, far-right.
Sorry.
Yes, far-right.
And white supremacist.
Yes.
Oh, and the according to the Irish Independent, I'm now a fascist.
Really?
Yeah. Another notch on my belt. But what that also means is that because the creative institutions are controlled by the progressive left, that there are lots of opportunities I'm not going to be given. It's less likely I sell film rights. It's less likely I get invited to various international literary festivals.
Does that bother you?
Not keenly. I've been to most of them already.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. I mean, there's a certain amount of bother. And one of the frustrations here is, of course, I don't have any evidence one way or another the degree to which I'm being discriminated against. And of course, I could be misinterpreting a certain amount of silence, and maybe I'm just old hat, or everyone hates my work for perfectly legitimate artistic reasons. So, you know,
it's none of those things.
Yeah, I'm aware of the fact there's a self-interest in determining that that maybe I'm not getting as many invitations as I used to because I'm political persona non grata. But I have my suspicions.
Yeah. You take on some pretty, not just in the novels, but in your columns, in your some of your writing about immigration, for example, is I can't imagine another writer, non-journalist writer, writing that. You know, just talking about how this is just an impossible situation we've got.
Yeah, I would say
no one.
That my writing about immigration has got me into the most trouble and has put the biggest stink on me because immigration is just to be celebrated no matter how extreme it is. And I don't feel that way. You know, I think Britain's culture is being threatened by a massive influx from very foreign cultures. And it's rapidly not the same country. If you take culture seriously, you have to take immigration seriously. For some reason, white people are told that they can't take their own culture seriously, but only other cultures, which are being not Western, are necessarily good. Sweden is discovering that
that's
not necessarily true.
Yes, exactly. In fact, in Sweden, some of their senior politicians in the past have said the most extraordinary things about incoming cultures. You know, we're just jealous of them, things like that, because they have they're bringing us stuff. We don't have any. I said, hello, wait a minute. You know, what happened to Ingmar Bergman? What happened to Biedermeier? What happened to whatever, you know? I do feel, I mean, obviously you're in Portugal, you live in Portugal now, don't you?
So yes.
You're looking at this from, I suppose, do you feel you're looking at Britain from the outside?
Not really.
Well, no one does anymore, you know, because you've got the internet and all of this.
I read all the same stuff I always did.
Yes.
I have the same friends who are still here.
No, I
lived in the UK for 36 years, and therefore I'm going to carry this country with me wherever I go. I'm stuck with it.
I do think with the immigration thing, actually, most people would completely agree with what you've written about it. And also, what's interesting is what's happening now is that all the various arguments for mass migration, even the economic ones, are falling away.
Yes, they are.
You know, they've either been challenged or they've been found simply not to be true. And then now people are these questions are arising in their minds. Well, if that's true, and it was never this and it was never that, why is it happening? Why? You know? I do feel that it is a kind of, there is a sort of watershed moment. You can, for example, now say, we have got to end mass migration. We have got to have a permanent halt to migration for a while. That's no longer actually so out there.
No, it isn't.
I mean, it's not just because I swim in these waters, you know, around here. It's just really not, you know. Things are changing.
But although I think we're, on a popular level, we're dealing with a sense of a baffled helplessness.
Yes. This is a great subject for you, maybe, isn't it?
It's the subject of my current manuscript.
Really?
Yes.
Is that a first?
Yeah, frying pan to fire.
Oh, well, that's... When could we expect a new book?
About halfway through the first draft.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how long it takes me.
Yeah.
I have always intended to write a novel about immigration and have never written it. I mean, there have been little intersections, little parts of novels that touched on it, but I've never done a book that was centered on that issue entirely, and I decided now's the time.
Yeah. Oh, it's
needed.
So we're
going to have to talk again.
It's needed. There has not been a novel or a play or a drama about one of the biggest things happening.
That's right.
There's not been one.
Absolutely transforming.
Yes.
The Western
yes.
world.
Yes.
In very short order, and nobody talks about it unless they're going to write about, you know, an Eritrean who goes on a long journey with lots of obstacles and finally makes it to the United States and suffers lots of discrimination and, you know, finally sets up a shop on the corner and it has a happy ending. I mean, the Western canon is actually full of books about immigration, but it's always the same story.
Oh, yes.
Right? It's always looking at things from the immigrant's point of view, and it's basically a wonderful thing. No one ever writes about the experience of the native population.
Well, no. I mean, or if they do, I do remember there have been a few plays going way back. I'm talking about way back till I Play for Today, the BBC stuff. And it was always essentially, if someone was anti-migrant, they were always either bigoted or possibly even mentally impaired.
Yes.
In some way. You know, the idea that you could set something in a street which has changed out of all recognition and be sympathetic to maybe the last couple there that were, you know, the white couple or whatever, it's pretty unthinkable, I think, now.
Yes.
So you're doing it.
I'm going to make an effort.
Thank you so much.
I don't expect to be thanked for it.
Oh, no. Well, you must please come back and talk about it. Thank you very much, Lionel, for that. Mania by Lionel Shriver, available now, well worth getting, reading. Thanks once again.
Always nice to talk to you.
Will you just stay with us, just because there are a couple of little questions for our members, exclusive content. But in the meantime, thank you very much. Lionel Shriver, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you next week. Have a good week in the meantime, won't you? Okay, bye-bye.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.